What are some of the resources, particularly of the church in the third world, to those of us in the first and second? Paul Hansen really picked up this morning with his whole notion of the new Israel of God. What happened when there was a contribution from surprising sources into a new kind of setting. Then we had a session with Joel on Central America, in which at the end of that, he especially talked about the shifted position and the contributions of the church in Latin America in a new kind of way. And in the afternoon settings brought us both a discussion from Will about the World Council, both the issues that make it controversial, but much of the essence, at least for me, of the World Council is the richness of the interpenetration and views from really representing a world church. And we had a session on disarmament this afternoon that looked at the variety of positions having to do with disarmament. And then John Schramm tonight talked about lifestyle issues. Enough is enough. And all of that, we're drawing on both biblical and world images for some directions about what it might mean to be faithful, to move in some new directions. And at least for me, when I was thinking about that, it's an issue, is stressed in our session this afternoon, of what does it mean to be both faithful as a church in this feast of life, and also what does it mean to be really creative? Not taking the standard norms, but being creative, being open to God's breaking in on us in new ways. And it calls for extraordinary forms of cooperation. And one of the images, which is good for me, is at least in some of the earlier travels when I was young, out in Wyoming. I don't know if any of you are from the Wyoming area. But the stories when I were coming through in Wyoming were about the wild asses that were still out roaming around in some parts. And those wild asses were often threatened by wolves that were up, or maybe they're timber wolves, I'm not sure the exact description, wolves that were up in that area. And that those wild asses have a marvelous way of cooperating and assisting themselves in times of threat. And so the description goes, I haven't actually seen that, it's only friends in Wyoming told me about it. And that what they do when they're threatened by the wolves is that all the wild asses put the smaller, your younger members of the herd in the middle, and then they all put their heads together. And they can simultaneously kick out and protect themselves when the wolves, when they come in. And my experience in the church is sometimes just the opposite. And that is that we put our heads out and we kick ourselves to death. Now, I'll go with the wild asses every time. And that is that particularly in a global community, we're going to have to find some ways both to be creative and faithful and cooperative. And I think there are some ways to move on that and to really do it. So part of what the session tonight was, you know, how do we move from where we are in some creative and new ways? And part of what we did last night was sharing. Let me give one of those from my side to kind of warm up on it and then say, now what do you see as the possible future directions in which we might go? And one of the things that came up in the disarmament section this afternoon when we were looking at gods of metal was that we put so much energy in the notion of fear, of holding back, rather than the creative energies of getting in touch with the world's peoples, not just government transactions, but the world's peoples, to understand our common passion for peace, our common passion for humanity, across, or at least through, the ideological lines that often separate us. And one of my own recommendations that came out of that, not my own, but one of the people in our group, Tom, had just come out of an encounter in Eastern Europe where he'd been in dialogue with people and helping them understand, but for himself understanding how the U.S. was viewed and perceived at that time. Joel Muggy has been involved with the Lutheran Church and taking people into Central America. And those of us at Plowshares Institute have a program where we're invited by third world leaders to spend 3 weeks living in the villages and dialoguing with people about new openings. And what I've discovered is that's not only hopeful, but life-changing. And one of the illustrations for me tonight comes out of one of the people who was involved in that program when 2 years ago we went to Africa as guests of the church and government leaders in Uganda, Tanzania, and Kenya. And the person who was with us at the time, used that illustration, was pastor. And he found for him a new way, as John Tram put it tonight, a new way of looking, a new way of seeing. Not just what he saw in Africa, but how he saw his own church as well. And my illustrations about the transformation of them is this pastor came back declaring that was really for him probably the most important continuing education experience he'd ever had. He came back, and by one of God's great providential acts, the next year was elected bishop. And have an unknown candidate, dark horse, whatever they call them, was elected bishop of one of the largest and oldest dioceses in the country, which Episcopal diocese, which should remain nameless at this point. But in any case, he came back, and the time for him to enter into this new position, right, and it was his, what I jokingly called his enthronement, but when he was made bishop and consecrated, and he decided that he'd just move into that in a gentle kind of way. So the first thing that he said in this view of the New World Church is that it would be all right to have it in the Episcopal Cathedral in the capital, but it was so small. So why didn't they just have it in the Catholic Cathedral, Roman Catholic Cathedral? It was considerably larger and it would accommodate everybody. So they agreed. And you imagine the Episcopal installation to bishop in the Roman Catholic Cathedral. But it was just a matter of size. You know, he just needed to move on that issue. And second, that he really wanted to have a lively event around worship. And what he wanted to do was draw in, for those who just arrived, tell you a story about a colleague who'd come back from an experience visiting the church in the third world, was about to be installed as the new bishop of one of the oldest Episcopal dioceses in America. And as he was planning what it would be, moved it first, as I said, into the Roman Catholic Cathedral, simply because it was large enough to accommodate everybody, but said all kinds of things. So of course the Archbishop, Roman Catholic Archbishop, needed to be present and participating in that thing. Second, they needed a little music to really get warmed up for the liturgy, and he knew this marvelous Black Baptist choir in the middle of the state. And he brought them up and they did the introductory. I tell you, we rocked the cathedral roof in terms of what they were. Also did change a little the ethnic mix that would have normally been present for such a service in that setting. And second, he said that although he didn't want to do battle on the issue in the Episcopal Church of whether women ought to serve Eucharist and be ordained, his colleague in the church had been a woman for the last 5 years, and for personal reasons she had to serve at the table with him. And then finally they went out of that door and into where the reception was traditionally held, and that was one of the great corporate headquarters in the United States that happens to be located across from the cathedral. It was always traditional to have the reception there, and if you can imagine what an Episcopal reception of that nature might be like, the lobster, a little caviar, and all that goes with it, and so people went through the line to be received at the great reception and found a long table laden with glasses of water. And in the middle was a little card which said, "I know you will support me in the decision to use the $10,000 normally going for this celebration for those who hunger in Africa." Simple statement of what the new administration was going to be like in that diocese, followed the next year by inviting a group of churchmen from South Africa as the guests of the bishop and the governor of the state to explore together the questions of investment, disinvestment, and apartheid, but to do it in a public arena to match the dialogue between nations. Now that, I thought, was some creative ways of trying to reach out and ask what it meant to learn from the church in the third world and be creative partners. Now I see those kinds of exciting and hopeful things everywhere I look in the life of the church. So we thought tonight we might ask you to begin by saying in the last couple of days of Advent, Christmas, and Liberation, or perhaps from your home churches, what have been some of the learnings, the new ways of looking that have started for you, new ways of looking at the world that have gotten started? And the second part of that, what are some new ways in which you see that the church might be faithful and creative and cooperative as we begin to venture out with a new trust in God's grace and presence in the world? Who wants to do some, what have you gotten in touch with in the last few days?
My idea of what the church can be about was really broadened when I became a representative of Partners in Mission. I don't know if you know what Partners in Mission is. Mm-hmm.
But you might tell the whole group briefly a little bit about that.
Pardon?
You might tell the whole group just briefly a little bit about that. It's Claudia, am I right?
That's right. Partners in Mission was formed by three people after a split in the Missouri Synod. They had been on the mission board for many years. Jim Mayer had been over in India for 18 years, and Paul Strady was administrator of the Orient, and Marion Kretschmar was just a general worker on the mission board. They decided to form a different kind of a mission committee in which the idea of partnership was a part of the philosophy of the organization, which meant that in the past we have always given. We've always felt that we were giving. When mission time came around, we gave. The idea was that we were also to be receivers. Yeah, but one of the ideas of Partners in Mission was to raise the conscious level of the people so that they would know what was happening in the other countries in the third world. And it really awakened me to many of the possibilities that the church could be doing. And I became very frustrated because as I would go to these meetings, and learn more about it and come in contact with some of these people, then I would try to go out and spread the word. And I couldn't seem to get it across. They just didn't understand what was happening. I've heard Jim Mayer, for instance, tell about giving a drink of water to a little girl in India. On one of the outcasts, and how much even that touch meant to his idea of what it meant to be in mission. And also, one time we were talking about people down in the third world, and he said, as long as you people are willing, as long as you people can buy bananas, 2 pounds for a quarter, the people down in the third world are going to suffer. Just little things like that that came out into our consciousness. And of course, we are supporting missions in Namibia and in Panama and in different parts of the world through Partners in Mission. But the idea is that we can not only be givers, we also need to be receivers because those people have something to offer to us. They have, if nothing else, their prayers for us.
And then often there are new models of ways in which to be faithful in the
world.
Good. That's helpful. Are there others? Thank you very much, Claudia. I think that's the imagery of cooperation and dialogue that for me are really kind of the things that keep alive that country.
And a very good friend of mine, a former pastor, is now going over to Namibia and to teach in a little seminary over there that has 4 professors, I believe. They're leaving the 1st of September, and of course that's a project we are all supporting, and we hope to learn more about the church over there through that, and also
they're talking about Africa. I don't know if you gave no David Meisenbring. He's going to be on the staff here next week. Next week. He was also a project of Parkinson Mission, and he came back to us with a better understanding of what's happening over in Africa and what has been happening over there in the church.
A lot of riches for your church, I don't know.
Why
don't we say our names as we get, not everybody's name I've quite gotten a hold of.
Bill.
Bill?
One of the things we're doing at our church, I live in Golden Valley in Minneapolis, in Minnesota, but just to heighten our awareness for Third World, a group of adults went to Ecuador a year ago, the pastor and so on. Now, what we're doing, myself along with the youth pastor, and 13 other young people, high school kids, are going to go over there this Christmas. And just to heighten our awareness, I'm not sure exactly what we're going to be doing, and I guess I'm open to some ideas. But we know, like it was being, they talked about today, you know, $50 or $100 is an annual income for some, a lot of families. So if we could, we're in a position, I think there's enough money in our church to, if we wanted to do something, we could do something. I guess what we'll have to do now is just ask them what we can do for them, I think. But I think that's a step in the right direction. And the other thing we're doing, we think we just built about a $2-3 million sanctuary, and we just want to keep those funds coming in. I think our annual budget is about $700,000-$800,000 a year. But we want to be able to give away as much as it takes for us to keep our church going, not to rest in our beautiful sanctuary, and to really be the church of God intended for us to be. I'm just really excited about that. I think there are about two or three churches in Minneapolis area that are doing that. You'd think, well, you can't give so much away because you won't have anything, you know. But those three churches are all growing, all different denominations. But those are the churches that are exciting to be a part of. And it's just really been I've never enjoyed being a part of a church so much. I've just kind of joined it. It's exciting.
It's great, really. I think your image of going in Ecuador to listen and to learn, being the model of Christ's encounter with blind Bartimaeus. If you remember that fast, what he does is, first of all, not assume what Bartimaeus wants, but ask him. And second, that it may be ways in which you all will have as much to learn from the Ecuadorian church as to give to. I think the contact on that's terrific. Al?
A rather neat thing happened to us a couple of years ago on a kind of a people-to-people relationship. I served two real small congregations in Illinois. Both of them are under 200 members, and one of them is Messiah in Henderson Grove, about 180 members. And we have a boy who was a junior in high school, Joe Brown, goes to Galesbury High School. And two summers ago, I think it is, he spent the summer in Kenya with the Future Farmers of America. And he came back and he stayed there with a family where the father was a minister of the Church of God, the wives parish all over the place. And he had a fascinating time. He came back and showed us some pictures and slides and so forth. The upshot of it was that the youth group of the congregation there brought together a lot of clothing that would fit the members of the family, and what didn't fit them they could use with their friends and so forth. A great big carton we sent over them, and received a very nice letter of appreciation in reply. Some time went on, and we got a letter from the wife saying that her husband passed away. She was really in a real deep grief and everything. And the Luther League sent her, or the youth group, we didn't call it Luther League, sent her $50. You know. Time went on, and then a package came to us, and it was a beautiful African drum. We got that as a kind of a remembrance of that kind of interchange. But it really left some real good feelings between these kids in our little country parish and this family over in Kenya.
Hmm. Good. Thank you.
I was reading John Schramm's little paper today on Tekoa, on the characteristics of an intentional community. And he has something in there about how one of the marks of it is good humor. And I was thinking about the times I've left here, these 10 days I've been here, but also about something that happened in Presbyterian Church with a friend of mine. This pastor in a town I will not name had in his congregation a Mrs. Carling, a Carling Black Label family. And the Carling family built a new warehouse for beer outside of the city, and she asked him if he would come dedicate it with a prayer. And so he decided that was worthy of some imaginative response, and so he wrote a letter to about 50 of his cronies in the ministry and said he was announcing a contest for the best dedicatory prayer of the new Carling Black Label beer warehouse. And that the prize would be a case of Carling Black Label beer. And so all these characters, all of them were Presbyterian, by the way. I'm sure the Lutheran wouldn't do something. And he got all these prayers in, and then he got a bunch of his cronies in that city to come over one night and over a case or two of Carling Black Label beer. They judged them and picked the best one. And when the day came, he went out and prayed that prize-winning prayer to the Lord as they dedicated that warehouse. And as I've reflected on that, I thought, you know, I bet God smiled at that too. How rare that kind of creative response to piety is. And I say,
is the prayer appropriate for the occasion, or what was the humor with the deal?
They set up their own criteria. I didn't pursue that question of the quality of it.
Did they have a party with a case of beer?
They gave the man who won a party and gave him his case of beer, yes sir.
I thought we were going to have it read to us as the next
day. I'm disappointed.
You want to fill everything out at the same time.
I thought you were going to say you won.
Yeah. That would have been nice too. No, I was in another state. I was a bit shocked at the time because in the state I was in, that kind of thing just didn't happen among the Presbyterian. I think one of the things that our council assembly is reminding me of that I was talking about this afternoon is the value of studying the Bible with people who are different, except they believe in Jesus Christ. And once we tried a Bible study, and when we got through with dealing with this passage, we asked ourselves, who's not here? And it was obvious that the Christians from other parts of the world weren't there, that there were no poor Christians there were no black Christians there were no Hispanic Christians there. And then we went back and said, well, if they had been here, what else might have been heard from this scripture that we studied that we didn't hear through our ears and eyes? And we sat there and looked at each other for 5 or 10 minutes, and nobody knew those people enough to say. And we just had a kind of confession, which led me to wonder what kind of freshness we get in our Bible study if we pursued it with Christians who are not just like us, across the class lines. You don't have to go overseas with Pentecostals, with ecumenical bodies. And that led me to think more than just Bible study. Once I came to our Holden Village type place in North Carolina from the World Council and had a workshop and a mission conference on ecumenical something. That's not a good word in all of the country I come from down here. And so I started off not by using that word, but by asking them, 20, 30 people in the room, how many of you are doing something Christian with Christians who are not Presbyterians? And everybody in that room was doing something. They didn't think of it as ecumenical, which was all right, but they were in emergency phone lines, suicide lines, food pantries, all kinds of things where they were Christian more than they were Presbyterians. And that made me sort of say that one of the ways to experience in the richness of the church is to have something to do with Christians who aren't just like us. However you define our homogeneous identity, try to do something with somebody else. And I think food pantry kind of work often is like that, where you're deeply involved with some people who are not just from your parish, and it gives another flavor to the experience in the parish.
Hi, everyone. Another kind of identification, and a relearning for me to bring that right up to the very present, is a decision to go through with some 50 or so other people in the community the fast day. I appreciated very much the decision that it be with everybody else. But that's the acknowledgement that we entered this with different motives and different reasons. And what I've gotten in touch with again, for me it was a reminder of the identification to help in some small way say, how does it feel like to, throughout the day, think that I'm hungry and to end up this evening with a headache, with a real feeling of lethargy, to have the escape to know that I've got just a few more hours to hang on because, boy, I'm going to hit breakfast tomorrow morning. Again, the realization that for so many people that's an all-the-time thing. And rather than that being a heavy on me, it has been more to get me in touch with understanding rather than judging so much of the world as lethargic or lazy or not thinking quickly, to realize how much of that condition is simply brought about by a lifetime of not the kind of nutrition that we have. That we really need to always be in touch with seeing the world through different eyes. And I guess for a tiny piece of today, I've been in touch with experiencing my environment through a different set of eyes. And that's been very, very important for me to do. And I just need to acknowledge that as a today learning in terms of a new world.
How do you feel about this approach? Most of us, are overfed, and I'm always watching my calories, and our farmers are so efficient. We have so much, we can't even use it, and that's why we have PIC programs. And I said, why don't we go to these countries with our methods and show them how they produce more food to take care of their people? One time when I brought this up a few months or a few years ago, somebody said, look, we can't impose our lifestyle on these people. Now, India people are starving and yet they got sacred cows. And, you say, well, look, we want to help you, but you got to do a little something yourself. But, and maybe the soil isn't adequate for our methods, but otherwise, you're trying to cure something with a Band-Aid. If you went over there with a few John Deere four-wheel drives, you could take care of things for a while.
I guess the best response for that to me has come out of an experience in Tanzania, where with that same mentality, the Canadian government put in an enormous, massive bread plant and so forth. With the processing, really gave it to the country and everything. And within a few years, even a few months, it was dysfunctional.
And what happened was that the only kind of wheat that it could grind was wheat that the country had to buy from North America to keep it going. The country didn't have the gasoline or the fuel to keep the machines going because that would mean on both accounts the purchase of the wheat and the purchase of the fuel was the precious
they would have to sell other things to get the money to buy that. And the third factor was the people didn't eat bread. And it's just not part of their diet. And that so often, in our loving care, that with the speed of our technology and the way that we think, how hard it is to stop and ask, what do you need? How do we respond that doesn't sell you products? And I guess it's the time element that I've come in touch with in the third world. That it's the speed, that they need to slowly work from, you know, from the ground up. And that's what's so terribly frustrating about that for me. And I guess I don't come with any easy answers to that. It's that other than I'm becoming increasingly aware that the mass production doesn't work. And it's been very hard for me to get in touch with that reality.
Yeah, one of my friends just came back from China recently. They have no unemployment problem. But somebody stands with a pole and a bucket and pours it on a plant, and that's their way of irrigating things. Well, you ain't never going to get anywhere in certain areas if that's the methods you use when you have this technology.
On the other hand, there is what is called labor intensive. So it means that almost everybody is employed even though they're doing a small amount. Now ultimately they're getting enough food to feed 1/4 of the world's people on only 1/7 of the arable land. So it's happening there. Rather than here where we have a massive degree of unemployment. And I guess it's which is a greater value for that culture. And if they are saying the greatest value is employment and feeding the people, maybe the technological advances can wait. And I guess it's seeing it from their eyes. It's hard for us sometimes.
I was very confused. This summer I spent 3 weeks in the Midwest, mostly in North Dakota. And the farms were lush. They had crop, one big crop after the other. And I heard about this pig program. I saw land that was lying, what do they call it?
Fallow.
And all of these farmers have great, big, gorgeous, beautiful homes. It's all this very expensive machinery. I had asked what some of the machinery was for. I became more and more confused because I'm on the emergency food program committee in Seattle, and I see all these lines of unfed people and hear about these people in the third world that are starving. What in the world is the matter? Plus my nephew, $32,000 just to put his crop in. They have a special insecticide program that's being used. And somewhere along the line, I just wonder how God is looking down upon us with all this abundance that we have. All the abundance I saw there this summer. And then I go back into Seattle and help in the feeding program and see these long lines of hungry people.
One of the things that we learned in the sessions that were done last week by Maria Bestemilla, which is in some ways a complicated problem, and that is the problem of our world today in terms of hunger is not having enough food, it's that it is poorly distributed. Mm-hmm. And I'm one of these, my friend who was talking about my Dunlap, the Dunlap left
disease
over my belt. obviously today's fast didn't hurt me much. But it is the context of where that distribution occurs. Like India is a marvelous example. Is that India now produces enough food to readily feed its own population. Point Henry Wilson was making last week. But it is so poorly distributed even within India itself, as in this country, that you still continue to have levels of mass starvation and inner city deprivation, and you have the extremes of very wealthy and very poor within the nation. And so it's not only that it's a world, across the world problem, but your illustration, it's also an internal one as well. But there are church programs that are working creatively at the redistribution of those resources. I remember one account of that has happened in Detroit recently. I don't know if anybody's from Detroit, where there were long issues of unemployment in the automobile plants, and also difficulties of distribution of food in some of the, or adequate prices for the food in some of the areas, farm areas surrounding it. And there was really a process of barter and exchange and supplying some of that food that wasn't getting prices on the market that were viable with people who wanted to work but were unable to, and to tide them over during a period until there might be new employment or retraining. Now that was a program where the church became a connector between people. They allowed those who wanted to work but couldn't be presently employed with others who had resources and skills, and they bartered and traded and worked together. That's a small program, but it was symbolic of putting people together with needs and interests that learned to cooperate together. And some of those laborers and farmers had never seen themselves as common allies and respondents in quite the same way before. So those are some of the images that I think are small scale, but begin to start at the problem itself.
An intriguing one, what you said about the bananas flashed in my mind. There's an organization called Parenting for Peace and Justice, and there's a write-up about a program where families study about Central America, the Philippines, and so forth, some of the greater suppliers of bananas. And dealing with the enormously inequitable price that to make that on our market, it is at a very low cost, and consequently down the line, those farmers in those countries receive enormously substandard wages. So these are families who have a little bowl on the table. And every time they buy a pound of bananas, the children or parents put the difference, what they have estimated to be the difference, in the bowl. And every couple of months, they send that to a mission that is working in the Philippines or in that country to turn back to the people what they assume to be the difference. It's a concrete way that this one family is trying to be aware and respond to that issue. It took some study to understand the difference. But those are the kinds of ideas that make you feel like there are some tangible ways you can respond to an enormous economic system that we don't always understand.
One of the things that's been following Al's question about technology, a lot of talk about appropriate technology. And we have an example of that in Geneva with a friend of mine that was in the Kapu with us, a Frenchman who had helped the Cameroons develop a chicken industry that was much more efficient than the one they had. But this one, there was a group of French companies that helped the Sahel drought problem by selling them irrigation systems or even giving them. But they had two problems. One was they had to buy gas, and that was just as the gas price went zooming. And the second was that when they got out of repair, they'd have to send to France for a repairman and buy parts and all that. So there was a double dependency created by that transfer of technology. So they began to ask, what's appropriate technology? And four of the scientists, of the engineers in this French company, decided on their own time they would try to create a windmill that wouldn't take foreign supplies to keep it going. The problem with a windmill is if you make it too rigid and it blows too hard, it's gone. So they created one with only one metal part, the center thing, and then any stick of wood and any kind of cloth and any kind of twine or rope, they figured out how to design a windmill that if it blew apart, all you need to do is get another stick and fix it back. And it would pump water out of a well and irrigate. So anyway, this colleague of mine was very excited about this. He knew these men and had visited them down in southern France. So he ordered one of these windmills, appropriate technology windmills, to be sent to the World Council, where he wanted to demonstrate appropriate technology. Well, I rode over to the council with him one morning. He said, "We got to go by the post office." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "I got to get a package." So I said, "Okay, I'm not in any hurry." So down I went to the, nobody else in the carpool would ride with Pascal because he always had some errand on the way. It was always some kind of fascinating errand. Well, anyway, we went into the Swiss Douan, this customs man there, and he told him who he was, and he says, "I have a package." And there was this big, long, looked like a coffin for a thin man over there on the floor. And he said, what's in the carton?" And he said, "It's a windmill." And this Swiss guard said, "What?" And he said, "It's a windmill." And he says, "What are you doing with a windmill here in Geneva?" And so he started to talk about appropriate technology, and the Swiss man said, "What are you going to do with it?" Because if he was going to sell it or make any money out of it, they were going to collect a lot of customs. He said, "I'm going to put it up on the hill like that, the Ecumenical Center, and show people what appropriate technology is." Well, there was no category in this customs office or in this customs officer's head to deal with something that crazy. So he said, "Come on back here." So we went back, and they took a hatchet and opened up this long wooden casket, and inside were four or five sticks and this one little metal piece and a bunch of cheap looking cloth and some string. And that made it even worse. He said, "What in the world are you going to do with that? Is that a windmill?" He said, "Yeah." And so Pascal began to pull it out to assemble this so he could see what it was. Finally, the guy just said, "Close it up, take it, go on. So we went out and put it in the back of his little French car, and it stuck out about twice as much far out of the trunk as it in, and went out to the World Council to set it. Well, the administration at the World Council wouldn't let it be set up on the hill. They put it down in the where the garbage was behind big high hedge to test it to see how it worked. So Pascal put it up down there. So in the carpool a couple of days later, we're going home. Asked Pascal if they were going to put it up somewhere. And he said, "Well, I don't know. It depends on whether the World Council accepts it, because the first principle of appropriate technology is the people must want it." And about a month later, it appeared on the hill. The official decision-making bodies of the staff had decided it was okay to put up appropriate technology and have that windmill going right up on the hill in Geneva. But it really sharpened for all of us the problem that you raised about how do you find a way that does not create greater dependencies in solving one problem that is caused by something like drought or something.
Learnings out of any of your sessions today, or your own meditations, or fastings, or responses, whatever they might be?
What the sequence meant for me, it really hit me how hard it was to break the Christmas patterns of stuff. You know, just of stuff. I didn't pull it off well, really, deep down. I somehow couldn't handle the good meal of turkey and the rice today, and the decorations and the memory of shopping, and the remoteness of this place, and Christmas 6 months off, 7 months off center. It left me kind of with all kinds of loose ends floating around. And I don't know whether the rest of it felt that way or not.
In my little home church Sunday, they had Christmas in July. And a little tree we got blocked it up from our woods. And it's the day when the people bring extra food. We always have a big emergency food car out in the narthex, but when they bring extra foods and stuff and put it under the Christmas tree in July and say, just sing Christmas song, Christmas in July.
Well, maybe it's a day that begins some options for people, and since we maybe, you know, some of us feel like elves, maybe it's time to close. Let me end with one piece that I like, appreciate what Will was saying about the sense of humor that is necessary. We've been dealing with all kinds of heavy stuff, problems, issues all day long that need to be worked on. Some creative and hopeful possibilities suggested in several areas. But the other problem is that we ought not to take ourselves too seriously. You know, there is a problem for thinking that we've got first steps or the final steps, remembering God's grace in between. So I'm going to read you a little passage in tonight, which comes from a friend of mine, Frederick Buchner. And some of the books I think are in the bookstore. This is called Wishful Thinking, a Theological ABC book that I recommend to you. Lots of good things in the bookstore. Actually, we were told to push our book, so I will before I go. There's a human rights book that has stories, by the way, from 9 different communities around the world struggling with some of the issues we've talked about. And they're in story form, so I recommend that, but I really recommend this one. Now let me read you the last piece of it, just to keep in perspective some of the issues of today and the days ahead until Christmas comes in December. And it goes like this. The fact that his name begins with Z is only one reason why Zacchaeus makes a good place to stop. He appears just once in the New Testament, and his story is brief. Luke 19:1-10. It's also one of the few places in the gospel where we're given any visual detail. Maybe that's part of what makes it stand out. And we're told that Zacchaeus was a runt, for one thing. And that is why when Jesus was reported to be en route to Jericho, and the crowds gathered to see what they could see, Zacchaeus had to climb a tree to get a look for himself. And Luke says that the tree that he climbed was a sycamore tree. We're also told that Zacchaeus was a crook, a Jewish leg man for the Roman IRS, who, following the practice of the day, got as much more as the going tax as he could get, and he pocketed the difference. So when people saw Zacchaeus oiling down the street, they crossed to the other side. And the story goes like this. The sawed-off shyster was perched up in a sycamore tree. And Jesus opened his mouth to speak, and all Jericho hugged itself in anticipation that Jesus was gonna give him holy hell. Woe unto you! Repent! Wise up! Was the least of what they expected. And what Jesus said is, come down on the double, I'm staying at your house tonight. The mob pointed out that the man he was talking to was a public disaster. And Jesus' silence was deafening. Now, it's not reported how Zacchaeus got out of the sycamore tree, but I suspect he fell out in pure astonishment. And then he said, I'm giving everything back in spades. And maybe he even meant it. And Jesus said, 3 cheers for the Irish. The unflagging lunacy of God, the unending seeminess of man. The meaning between them is always a matter of life or death, and usually both. The story of Zacchaeus is the gospel in sycamore, and it's the best and oldest joke in the world. Zacchaeus may be like us. He fell out of the tree in pure astonishment when Jesus spoke. But like Holden, it's good to remember that he fell into the arms of a community that both held him accountable and forgave him. And therefore he can start again.